Mr. Buffery, Real 4. We're talking about when you joined HMS Bullen at Belfast in March 1944. What about shipboard routine when you settled yourself into it? What was your role? Because you were a telegraphist S.
Telegraphist, yeah.
And also, I know you became, assistant... And if you could sort of slot this into a sort of routine so we can follow your day.
Any member of the crew had two duties. One was the normal ship's duty, if you were a seaman, you would carry out all sorts of seaman duties, which would be allocated by the petty officers and through the first lieutenant. In action stations, you had a gunnery position or some more activity. And my action station was in practice navigator gunman, and that extended in my case to my non-technical duties when I was on watch. So for any other time, you see, but in the Navy, I think they still use this, these are what they call a three watch system. You have morning, you have three watches, and you take morning, afternoon, first dog, second dog, evening, and the middle, which becomes the middle. 12 to 4 in the morning, and then the morning watch would be 4 to 8. And then, so the first would be not 1st to 8, and then the morning watch would be 8 to 12. So that's the routine, as far as I know, as we have been in the Navy. So at sea, my watch would be one of those. Selected out of three in succession. There were three of us that were special operators. Huffduff, they called us Huffduff, because it was HFDF direction finding, and they used them as phonetic as Huffduff. So the navigator's aim was to look after the charts, prepare the charts for sea, and that meant making any corrections that were in Admiralty fleet orders, which would be coming in by marines from the port station. And as I say, doing the clocks, seeing the plots.
But doing the clocks, could you just explain that for the tape?
Well, all the clocks in a ship would be related to the local time reference, and on most ships it would be the average of two position watches that were kept in the chart room in boxes. So you take the boxes out, look at the watches, and if there was a discrepancy between the two of them, you take the average. And this is something you did as a matter of routine once a day, and then you go around and you with your watch that you corrected to the average of those two. And you set all the clocks, and it's about 12 minutes. And by the time you've done the ship, you might be 20 minutes later, you see. So it was accepted that there wasn't very much error between the chronometers. And incidentally, these days it's different because you've got a time, the GPS system makes all this.
So you'd go around the ship daily. You'd meet a lot of people. I think you said that off tape. If you just go through, it gave you. You were going through everyone.
I know you actually met people, but you knew who they were. For example, if you went down the engine room, there was a chap with a cap on with garland on his peak. You knew it was chief petty officer and that sort of thing. You see. And then there was only one other person that was more senior to him, and that would be the engineer officer. Now I knew him, and the people that worked in the engine room were accommodated in a different area to us. You see, they would be down the back end of the ship. In the galley, we'd have to go in the galley and get and check the clock there. So you've got to know who the various cooks were. And go down to Pelops' Mess and SBA and engineers, engine room staff, stoking staff. They were really the people who organised the oil flow. Stoker was a man who heaves coal into a boiler, but since we didn't have any boilers.
And any other duties as navigator's yeoman? There's the adjusting the maps, updating the maps, and the clocks. Anything else?
Sometimes you have to go into the, if we're in Liverpool, we went into the Royal Naval Building where the naval officer in charge, he had his office, and we'd pick up the local fleet orders directly. But sometimes they would send out a wren on a circuit to all the ships in the dock, but that wasn't very often.
Did you look forward to those visits ashore? I mean, when you went...
Oh, well, it was different, wasn't it? Something you didn't normally do, you know. Met people in the dock, in the library or in the office.
Now, what about your other duty as HFDF, HFDF rating? What exactly were your duties there? If you could just run through them. I know some of it is repeat, but what exactly were you doing?
Well, each one, when we were at sea, as soon as we put outside the bar, we'd be on watch. One of us would be on watch. And you just sat there and you listened to every message that was passed on your frequency. And quite a lot of it was routine messages to ships, German ships.
And how did you know which frequency to monitor?
Well, we were told which frequencies to monitor every... There was a routine, and these people use one frequency at a certain time of the day, and then they change it because the reception wasn't good on that frequency at that time of the day, so they'd move it around a bit. Probably it was a security move as well. But we had a definite instructions on what frequency to be on for every part of the day, and you had to make sure when you got on watch that you were on the right frequency. I'm not sure where that information came from, but whether it came from the wireless room as a matter of local change, or if it was a schedule. I think it was scheduled actually.
And what could you describe your receiver? Which one was it?
The chart room was behind the wheelhouse, and the wheelhouse was below the captain's conning position. Now, if you look on the ship, there's an open bridge, and then there's a closed bridge, and then there's what was underneath it? Something else was below it. I'm not sure what that was there. And behind the closed bridge, there one side was the captain's sea cabin, and the other side was the chart room. Well, that chart room contained an automatic plot, so in an action condition, that plot would be set going. So you plot where you'd been.
Now, how did that work, the automatic plot? It
was taken off the compass, the gyro compass, and the ship speed, ship's log. So the compass gave the angle relative to north, magnetic north, and this would give you a deviation from the magnetic north for however long you were going along at that speed, and then the speed was related from the ship's log, electric log. So that was an effective plot of the action during the time when it was live. Now, behind that, there was a chart, there was a layout table.
What was that?
It was a table where you could lay out charts and take them out of the drawers and lay them out for navigation purposes. So you didn't cover the plot. Then on the other side of the, opposite the chart table, there was a radar set, quite a sophisticated radar. And then behind that, filling in a corner, was our little cubby hole with the direction finder.
So the radar set would be operated by the
by another operator.
A radar personnel. And you were on, what was your machine called? This was the machine you mentioned earlier.
Plessy FH4X.
H-A?
FH4X.
And could you describe how you used that machine? You know, I mean, what controls did it have on it, if you still remember? I know it's a long time ago.
It was painted blue. It was a rectangular box about 8 inches high, about 15 inches wide, I suppose. At the top of it, in the middle, was a CRT tube, which was about 5 inches in diameter, I suppose. Like an oscilloscope, effectively, that's what it was. And down the side, there were all sorts of controls. In the middle, there was a sense switch, which switched out two of the coils on the antenna, so you could tell from which direction the signal is coming. So you've got an ellipse on the screen. An ellipse is formed by a circle which is at an angle. So you see, so if that gives you that ellipse shape, and that's north, you know roughly, you know where the signal's coming from, so it's 20 degrees. But you don't know if it's 20 degrees or if it's how many plus 20. So the sensor tells you, takes out half of it, you see. So it gives you the absolute direction. And then down the side of the machine, along its depth, at the bottom, were four coils on each side, which had to be changed to change the frequency. Now you had a chart which told you which coils had to be inserted to give you a particular frequency. Now you had to do that within that period of, what was it, 15 seconds or something like that.
Could you manage it? You know, I mean, or did sometimes you get caught on the hop?
I don't think we ever managed it, quite frankly. I mean, I remember once I got a signal which I thought was something coming from somewhere down in the ship. It was so strong. I blurted out my frequency letter on the RT, and I changed the coils. I managed to change the coils, and I think just at the end, I managed to get a bit. And I signaled this back up to the bridge, and we got a signal later on that this thing was 600 miles away. It was the best signal we ever had. I didn't say what happened.
So what you were doing basically is just monitoring all the German signals. Was there much German signal traffic?
Yeah.
Where was it coming from?
I think it came from Brest. Transmitter at Brest. The only way you could tell whether it's coming from Kiel or Brest or one of these stations was the strength of the signal. From Kiel, that's another, 500 miles away or so, whereas Brest was almost on top of you if you were in the Atlantic.
And so this traffic had come through, and what would you do with that? Just ignore
it? I'd log it. You know, you have to write it all down. It's all logged.
And then you went into this emergency thing. When you got the U-boat B-bar signal, that was the emergency. Was there anything else that would be an emergency? Was there a surface, you know, I mean...
Yes, I was saying, there were other codes that I can't remember at the moment because I think there was a double H, actually, or a double H bar or something like that for other things, but there might even have been something for airplanes, but because, you see, these were signals from active units back to the base rather than the base to the active unit. That was... All naval signals are sent out as a worldwide signal. So if you're in the Far East, you might get some used in the European. But rugby, which is the naval transmitter, which now they use these, transmit to these clocks from, that was a naval transmitter. And it just transmitted all sorts of routines throughout the day, the whole time.
So you were constantly, so you'd have headphones on?
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be watching this?
Yeah.
Well,
yes, it would be going, and it might not be very clear, it might be fuzzy, but it would be on. Yeah, you have to have it on, otherwise.
Ready for the B-bar.
Yes. Whatever. I mean, it might be that there was a surface radar attacking a convoy, see, but that would, the routine was that if you were going to attack, you sent a signal to the base. In other words, do I have your permission to attack, you see? Seems silly to me. You give away your position and announce you're going to attack. Anyway, that's what they did. And of course, the sub had to surface to send the translator. But that was the system.
And you were just with your headphones on. Well, how loud were the headphones? I mean, was it very loud or...?
Well, you could adjust it down to suit... I mean, sometimes you'd only have one earphone on. Put one forward up here so that you couldn't hear it.
Now, the Aztec people used to say that sometimes it drove them mad.
Yeah.
Was there any sort of problems with just sort of listening to this Morse all day? Well, not all day, all watch.
That's what I say, that in the training period, a lot of people did go bananas because of the effect on their mind of the Morse.
But
that took them first before their ability with Morse become, started to suffer. They suffered from the Morse problem.
But you didn't. Did you suffer from listening to this all?
No.
Were you 2 hours on, mostly?
Three hours. 4 hours on.
Four hours. So you wouldn't split the shift on it. You were on for the full four hours.
They did actually, didn't they? Half an hour. Yeah.
But you were on. When you were on.
Yeah.
And.
Incidentally, those Aztec operators were seamen. You know, they were trained to use the Aztec. They weren't trained as Aztec operators. He got a little badge to say that he was capable of using the Aztec, but they were, as you say, they were half hour on, and if the rest of the time they'd be acting as a seaman, you see.
Now, so what would you? So we've looked at. You had one thing. You were the navigator's yeoman, and then the other thing, you were on watch. Mm. What would you do if you weren't doing either of those things?
You might be helping out in the mess, cleaning something up. Doing the spuds or doing your own way of occupying time, listening to wires.
So just waiting for next time to go back on?
Yeah, sleeping.
Yeah. Did you find that you got tired after a stint of 4 hours on concentrating? You must have been concentrating.
Well, of course, when you came off watch in the morning, you weren't allowed to go, you weren't allowed to sleep. You had to do turn two, as they call it, until midday.
Turn two being?
Going to do some work, helping to run the ship. So I might be doing my yeoman's job then, you see. Might be the clocks.
Whereas the Aztec operators, they were allowed to sleep.
No, I don't think anybody was allowed to sleep before noon. Yeah.
And did you enjoy the work? I know it sounds daft, but...
Yes.
Now, how about the other people on the ship? How did you get on with your other HF to Hufduffs?
Well, one of them was a communist, so he didn't get on with him very well. And the other one was a youngster, not that I was, no, he was about my age, I suppose. Yeah, I didn't think he was totally very, no, interesting. I don't think he was a very interesting person, so he was there, and, you know, we got along all right.
How did you get on with the rest of the crew? Because sometimes the specialists, the communications people, vary, you know, are a little separate from the seamen. They're seen as being a bit elitist.
The other way around, actually, you know. It isn't a small action from the communication. It's the other way around. They think that the communicating crew have got something that they ought to have. But, so it really never affected me. Yes. I mean, I don't know what Steve said anything about that to you, but it's never a concern.
And you got all right from your side. You got on all right with the seamen, and the stokers.
Those that I had to deal with, yes. Oh, yes.
No friction at all.
No.
Did you think in your own mind that it took a bit more to be an HF Hufduff?
Well, only in as much that I've been told that when these people failed the course, they went as wiremen. Now, one of them was a person that was associated with setting torpedoes. Now, the whole exercise of a ship, a warship, is to set off some belligerent activity, isn't it? And that included the torpedoes. And I thought that wasn't a step down, that was a step up, really. And I think they also did the mines, they set the mines as well.
The depth charges.
Yeah.
Now, what about the petty officers? Who was your who was in charge of you? Did you have a petty officer in the?
Yeah, we had a.
Do you remember his name?
Yeah, I mentioned it, didn't I? The chief petty officer Potts, to use the synonym, is Peter Ennis.
What was he like?
Very good.
What type of chap was he?
He was always going on about the communists, probably because we had a communist in that group, and he knew it. But he was always going on about what we did in the Far East Station. And subsequently, at one of the reunions, I said to him, said to his wife, "How long were you out in China?" She said, "I've never been to China." I said, "Well, your husband always came on about on the ship about the China station. He's never been to China."
That's why you say he was a bullshitter. Was he a good petty officer?
He was quite good. Used to walk at that desk. But bawling his head off.
Was he fair in the way he treated you?
I think he was all right. Yeah, I think he was quite good. And there are some people who throw the weight about, you know, they're getting a bit of rank and that's it, or rating rather, and everybody suffers, but you can't put it off.
What about the other petty officers and, you know, or leading seamen in that came that you knew? Were they all right?
Well, there was the seamen, leading seamen. Leading yeoman, chief yeoman here, and Alf Dunham, who was he's the most senior signalman.
And what was Alf Dunham like?
He was very good.
In what way? What was good about him?
Well, he was a good personality. He knew his stuff. He was active. He was always there when he needed. And you know, chief yeoman, particularly in the harbour, is in demand because everybody wants to send signals past all this land or run up signals or something like that. And usually that's the way they do it rather than radio.
Any other petty officers or leading seamen? Coxswain or anybody?
Well, the coxswain, had his office on the other side of the ship to our mess deck. And I always remember the only time I ever saw him was he always wore a white hat. You know, the tropical rig was cats with white, whereas in Europe you don't wear cats with blue. You don't wear white hats unless you're outside. And he always wore his white hat, or tropical cat. When he came, he charged down from the top step and hit the deck about 8 steps later, and then dived into his cubbies on it. And that's the only thing we ever saw him.
Do you remember?
Where he was expected to run to come the boat.
Do you remember his name? It's all right, don't worry. Perhaps it'll come to you. What about the officers? I mean, the navigating officer, you must have had something to do.
Yes.
What was he like?
He was quiet sort. He told you what he wanted and let you go on with it. Yeah. And, we had a... I think there was a second. I think he chose me because I'd worked at the Admiralty and I knew something about drawing, you see, and I suppose that was his basic reason for doing for choosing me. I gathered from Steve that he was he's not young man until I turned up, so I wonder if that put Steve's name there, okay, actually.
And what about Parrish himself, Anthony Parrish, the captain, Lieutenant Commander, what was he like?
I never had much to do with it, actually. But, you know, I mean, I would see him in the chart room or on the bridge, or if I happened to have to go on the open bridge, and he's on watch, I'd see him there. But I don't think I had any dealings with him as such.
Was he regarded well within the crew? I mean, before the sinking, I'm talking about. I mean, as a ship's captain, or was he just didn't make much of an impact?
I don't really think he impacted, certainly not on us, on our mess deck, as I don't know about the rest of them. No, I don't think, I wouldn't say that he had much impact on our group.
And then you had a bunch of sub-lieutenants, probably the ones who used to be midshipmen, Howie, Ralph, Clark, and then the lieutenant engineer, Grossen, and Spencer. Any impressions of them?
Well, one of those would be the chap that would be our reference, our senior officer, our officer. Oh, that's interesting. They're all temporary lieutenants.
These are the ones that were promoted, I presume, from midshipmen, acting lieutenants.
Yes. So that's why they're temporary lieutenants, you see.
Now, what would you say the ship was a happy ship?
It was quite easy day, you know.
There was no underlying troubles, as far as you were aware.
No. On a ship like that, the biggest trouble would be too much regimentation, too much discipline. But I turned up on another ship later on, and it was completely different.
But so there wasn't too much regimentation.
No.